Every month we get to meet people whose individual stories are intertwined with the story of the region. Stories of Southern Oregon are compiled by Maureen Flanagan Battistella for the Southern Oregon Digital Archive, SODA, at the Hannon Library at Southern Oregon University. This month, Maureen is back with Max Bennett, who has his eyes on the timber industry and its changes through his work in forestry and natural resources with the Southern Oregon Research and Extension Center, SOREC. He's based in Josephine County. Welcome back first, Maureen Flanagan Battistella. Always good to have you.
Nice to see you. Thank you.
And Max Bennett, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's good to have you. So your research seems to focus largely on forest health. Are we thinking about that general subject area in ways we do not think about it when you were first getting your training to get into this line of work?
Well, forest health has always been a huge concern for the clientele that we work with here at the Extension Office for forest landowners, whether large or small. Whether it's public lands or private lands, and forest health, maintaining a healthy forest is usually right up there at the top of concerns for folks when they have forest land that they're managing, and that it happens to be very intertwined with our concerns with wildfire as well.
Yeah, on a day like today, let's give an example there. I mean, when you look at the set of conditions that are just ripe for a fire to spread quickly, what do you think about in terms of forest health?
Well, this, you know, these red flag conditions that you mentioned just a moment ago are obviously extremely concerning, but these conditions are influencing forests that have accumulated fuels over many decades from excluding past wildfires. And I think as many of us understand locally, and I think this is better and better understood by the broader public, we have a fuels accumulation problem. And so when we have these dry conditions, the types of fires that are fueled are increasingly large and severe. And so those same overgrown conditions out in the woods are also some of the factors that influence forest health. So excessive density, the things that we're seeing with climate change, hotter and drier summers are really causing increasing levels of tree dieback, tree mortality. And so the same factors that influence fire are also influencing forest health.
So it's not just a matter of a risk of fire. It's just that it's not particularly good for a forest to get to this level of overstockedness, if that's a word.
Yeah, I like that term, overstocking or overgrownness, to coin a term. And, you know, we certainly see that here in the Rogue Basin. Many forests are indeed overgrown, and so the competition for site resources, moisture in particular, soil moisture, is such that trees just become really stressed, and they're more vulnerable to insect and disease problems, things like bark beetles, for example.
All right. So when there's a limited amount of moisture and you've got a bunch of trees trying to bring up the same level of moisture, none of them are doing particularly well from the sounds of it.
That's right. Yep.
Max Bennett, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange in this month's edition of Stories of Southern Oregon, compiled by Maureen Flanagan Battistella, who is with us as well. If you have questions about forest health and forest practices and how they've changed over the time of Max's career, join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Max, when you were talking about the clientele, you mentioned public lands too. I mean, they have such an array of scientists and people who know the processes on federal lands. Do they ever come visit you guys at the state level and say, hey, what do you know?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the Extension, you know, of course, we have a strong research program at the Oregon State University at the College of Forestry, and there's quite a bit of interaction with federal land managers, for example, through the Pacific Northwest Fire Science Consortium, which comes out of Oregon State and is kind of a partnership with the university and with the Forest Service and other federal land managers. So there's a lot going on at that level. Locally, we do interact to some degree with the federal agencies the Extension Service, my program, is involved in some of the collaborative forest management, collaborative forest restoration projects that are happening around the basin.
And talk about those, because I've seen them come and go. I mean, I remember watching the Applegate Partnership sprout up after 1990, which led to the creation of the Applegate Adaptive Management Area under the Northwest Forest Plan. There have been others. Tell us about whether they have borne as much fruit as people hoped they would when they started.
Yeah, I think we have some great success stories. Of course, the Ashland Forest Resiliency Project, which you're very familiar with, right there in the watershed, has been extremely effective in terms of treating lands, making them less prone to high severity fire, improving forest health, reducing the risk of dangerous fires, and also building public understanding of the need to do these kinds of treatments. So the Ashland Forest Resiliency Project has been quite successful, and there are other efforts that are emerging in the Rogue Basin. There's the Rogue Forest Restoration Initiative, which includes a number of the partners in AFR and others, including Extension, that have funding from the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board to do treatments in various locations, in the Applegate and elsewhere. And I think there's a lot of momentum developing to do more of these kinds of collaborative all-lands projects. The challenge is having enough funding and enough capacity to do the work, because it tends to be expensive, and there can be some offsets from selling some of the material that is harvested, but in many cases the treatments are non-commercial, and so it costs a lot of money to do it, and it takes a lot of people to plan the projects and to administer the projects. So capacity is a real issue.
Let me flip that analysis from non-commercial to commercial. It seems like in decades past, you would have financed the project, for example, by selling off some of the big trees, which is not necessarily the best ecologically for the environment.
That's right. So a lot of these restorative treatments are doing what we call thinning from below, which are removing smaller diameter trees to reduce the competition in the fuel loads to promote the health, vigor, and longevity of the larger trees. And so in many cases, such as in the AFR project, we're really seeking to promote those larger trees. In some cases, the thinning does generate commercial material, by removing some of the smaller subordinate trees that are large enough to sell to a mill and process. But again, in a lot of cases, they're too small and they don't pay their way out of the woods.
And it seems like too, Max, as I watch the projects that do seek to remove some stuff from the woods to make them more fire resistant, like in the Ashland Forest Resiliency Project, they don't go fast. That is for sure. Where a fire could blaze through there in a matter of hours, it seems to take years to decide the best approaches and prescriptions to what to take out, how much to take out, and then what to do with it once you got it.
Yeah, it definitely is a complex process, and this gets back to the capacity issue that I was mentioning. So, you know, these treatments aren't just done, you know, you just don't have folks running out there with chainsaws willy-nilly. It takes a lot of planning to figure out, given limited resources, where are the most important areas on the landscape to treat, and how can these prescriptions be designed in a way that improves forest health and reduces the potential for fire, high severity fire, but also maintains complex forest habitat for at-risk species like the northern spotted owl, and also maintains good water quality and recreational potential, and the list goes on. So designing these projects is really pretty complex and takes a lot of specialists, a lot of experts, and a lot of planning and thought. And so to do them well, it just does typically take some time and staffing.
Sounds like a puzzle with a lot of pieces, some of them very, very small.
That's right.
Max Bennett, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange in this month's Stories of Southern Oregon. He works with the Southern Oregon Resource and Extension Center, SOREC, and Forestry and Natural Resources. Maureen Flanagan-Battistella, the curator of Stories of Southern Oregon, with us as well. You may join the conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Max, without asking your specific age, give us an idea of when you entered the forestry picture. Was this post-1990, so after the spotted owl listing, all that stuff?
Yes, I started right about then and started graduate school in the early 1990s, and I came here to Southern Oregon in late 1999, so I've been here for a little over 20 years.
So for that, for your own education, was there some sense of a lot of things that people had taken as gospel getting ripped up in those years as things were approached from a different direction?
Yeah, I think so. There was, the story of forestry and forest management, not just locally, but sort of regionally and even nationally and internationally, has been a change from a focus primarily on timber production to the management for a much broader set of values that still includes timber, but includes other things like clean water and habitat, recreation, carbon storage, just kind of that whole suite of values or ecosystem services, as we sometimes call them. And so when I started my education, the spotted owl issue was kind of at its height, and there was the big change in the management of federal lands with the Northwest Forest Plan that put in place a number of large reserve areas and really significantly reduced the timber harvest on federal lands in the Pacific Northwest. So, that all happened in the early 1990s, and that was sort of what I followed as I was going to graduate school, and that's what we were talking about.
I was reminded the other day in a discussion about the Pipe Fork Project in Josephine County, which I suspect you're familiar with, that under the Oregon Forest Practices Act, you have to leave 2 trees per acre, not flatten the entire landscape. There are things that have changed in state rules as well, which makes me just wonder in general about does the managing of forests and restoring ecosystems ever seem to reach a point of stasis, or is it constantly evolving?
I think it's constantly evolving because new issues come to the fore and, conditions change and also societal expectations change. So it's just a constant evolution. I mean, we were talking about habitat conservation and how to reconcile that with timber production back in the 90s, but there wasn't a lot of focus on climate change, for example, mm-hmm. and now for obvious reasons, we're experiencing climate change, and so thinking about managing forests in the face of these changes is something that's that's a major focus.
Let me take a phone call here. We have Ann in Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Max Bennett from the Southern Oregon Research and Extension Center.
Thank you. Well, the question that I have is, since the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management have been starved of resources for the last 40 years, what effect has that had on forest health and being able to do these prescribed burns and other ways of mitigating these dangers to the forest? Thank you.
All right, thanks, Ann. Appreciate that. Max, what knowledge do you have about the?
Thanks for the question. So, yeah, it's had the lack of resources has had a huge effect on the ability to manage and restore forests. So, a lot of the funding has been spent on firefighting and because we've had more and more fires and larger fires, and so that has tended to raid the budget for the more proactive treatments like prescribed fire and thinning. And also staffing has been substantially reduced. If you compare, for example, the way it is today to what it was 20 or 30 years ago. So capacity, both in terms of staffing and in budgets, to do these restorative treatments has been reduced just at the time that we need more capacity. So it's a real issue, I think.
Well, let's talk about the kind of clientele you get then, because I'm guessing you deal with a fair amount of small woodlot owners who would own a few acres of land, want to get the trees out, want to make sure they follow the Oregon Forest Practices Act. How much has stuff changed for people at that level of the business?
Yeah, there's been a lot of, some things have remained fairly constant, like that focus on forest health and fire, but there's definitely, I think, a lot of new landowners that are coming into the area that have more of a focus on the amenity values of forest land, so habitat and aesthetics and, maintaining and preserving ecosystems.
Go ahead, Maureen. You had something you wanted to bring in there?
Well, safety, too. I think the small landowners have some prerogative in protecting their own structures on the property.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. And so that's been a big part of our educational focus in recent years, is helping folks understand how to make their homes and properties more fire safe. So what can they do right around the house? What can they do on their woodlot or their small forest to protect their home in case there's a fire, or to create a fire that is less damaging if one were to occur?
What is a small lot owner? How many acres does a small woodland lot represent?
Yeah, it's, it could be anywhere from an acre to 5,000 acres. I mean, in most cases, we're talking about people, and so that's a pretty wide range, where in most cases we're talking about people, that have 10, 20, 40, 100. There are a lot of folks in that range.
And more of them now than there were, as compared to the larger industrial forests?
Yeah, they comprise about 25% of the forest land base in Jackson County, for example. And there are more now. There probably has been some parcelization or some subdivision, so there are probably more owners than there were, let's say, 20 or 30 years ago.
You have an annual conference, don't you, Max?
We do have a variety of different educational programs. We've had an annual conference called Living on Your Land and Tree School, but with COVID, we have migrated to kind of more of an online educational delivery. So we are doing a lot of virtual programming these days.
Great.
And I was going to ask you, too, about the Land Steward Program, because we talked about that before on the exchange.
Yeah, yeah.
But it would seem that would be a major way for you to make connections with, as you point out, the greater number of small woodlot owners, some of whom may be coming from places where they haven't had to manage land on this scale before.
Absolutely. And that program does, I think, a really great job of reaching those owners and getting them up to speed on what it takes to live, safely in rural areas in southern Oregon. So that program has been very successful in helping those owners better manage their properties.
And you mentioned climate change, which certainly has to be an increasing part of what gets talked about. I mean, we're seeing things that we didn't used to see. I can't remember being awakened at 2 o'clock in the morning by the bedroom door slamming shut from a hot wind, but that's what I got today, So
yeah, right.
So I just wonder how much this begins to get pushed further into the things you're learning, teaching, and adjusting programs, like teaching people who own land how to manage that land.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, as I said, climate change is a major focus, and in many cases it sort of just accentuates the reasons for doing things like thinning and reducing overstocked forests that are needed for forest health and fire reasons. So it doesn't necessarily send us in a totally different direction, but in terms of management, but just is another reason to do those sorts of treatments. As the climate gets hotter and drier, the need to have appropriate densities in the forest is even greater.
All right, so you might actually spread things out a little further than you might have, say, 10 or 20 years ago?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And think about species composition and, you know, what species work best on particular sites, given the sorts of changes that we're seeing.
Right, so even that, like south-facing slopes in our region, for example, would be a different kind of thing too, huh?
Right, yeah, so maybe accentuating a little bit more pine and oak on some of those harsher sites, and that would be one example.
We have an email from Grumpy John and Grant, not an email, a drop-off phone call from Grumpy John and Grant's Pass asking about fire suppressant chemicals. What you know about those, whether the toxicity has changed over the last 20 years, whether it's improved at all?
Well, I'm not super well informed about the environmental effects or toxicity of fire retardant. My impression is that it's fairly safe, but I have to confess I'm not super up to speed on that.
Mm-hmm. So your approach seems to be to focus more on the forestry end of things than the economic end of things. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the economic piece of it is important, and you know, we work with the set of objectives that landowners bring to the table. In some cases, they are pretty economically focused, but I would say most are not. But figuring out a way to pay for all of those treatments is definitely part of the economic picture.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's not making profits, but it's figuring out a way to pay for those thinnings.
All right. Always learning something new in the woods. Max Bennett, our guest in this month's edition of Stories of Southern Oregon with Maureen Flanagan Battistella. Max, thanks for joining us from SOREC.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye now.